an original.
From Story Studio Network.
Well, we made the turn into February, and yes, there is an R in February. Let's not ignore it. Let's not abuse the R. There are two R's. Make good use of both of them. Thank you. Yes, indeed. First day of February. It's the shortest month of the year. Woohoo! And it's always kind of the rough month. It's going to be in these part of the world. We're here in Toronto. Colder the next few days, but feeling a little bit like winter. And we were lucky to have January in the rearview mirror based on the forecast that we had. All right, Dave Trafford here. It's Now and Next for Story Studio Network. Coming up on the program today, we're going to talk to Toronto lawyer Courtney Betty. And he is a longtime community activist as a lawyer, involved in community engagement, particularly the Black community here in Toronto, but, you know, various races and so on, in terms, particularly in terms of the relationship with police services. Mm-hmm. So we'll get into the conversation. The reason that we wanted to bring him on was more or less against the backdrop of the Tyree Nichols story. And, of course, the funeral being held today for the young guy that was, basically beaten to death by Memphis police. Some serious charges involved there now, obviously, including second-degree murder. A number of first responders have lost their jobs. Other police officers and sheriffs have lost their jobs as a result of all of this. Does that make a difference? We'll get into that coming up here on Now and Next with Courtney Betty. But first, a few of the news stories that we want to bring you. We'd like to do that, right? Sort of our version of the daily news and the story of the day, or a larger in-depth interview. And we can kind of get you through and up and through your day. Here's a couple of notes that we want to touch on. Later today, I am off to attend an event that's being promoted by and sponsored by the folks at the Daily Bread Food Bank. And essentially, it's an art exhibit that's focusing on the whole issue of food insecurity in this country, but particularly in major urban centers. And it's kind of a cool thing. It's taking action on food insecurity and housing instability. So it's being co-hosted by folks at Daily Bread and YWCA Toronto and the Toronto Foundation. And it's just intended to kind of kickstart this discussion around food insecurity. And let's face it, the reason for the heart of food insecurity is poverty. And we produce a podcast called the 2030 Project with the folks at Daily Bread, and it's all about reducing poverty. Food banks are important. Right now they are, but we want to put them out of business. And they play a vital role. Thousands of people a day attending food banks, right? Last November, they issued their Who's Hungry report. And in November alone, there were 208,000 visits to food banks, more than 2 million food bank visits in the calendar year of 2022. It's going to be even higher in 2023. How do we know? Well, because the research and the projection by Daily Bread suggests we're going to have more than 250,000 visits to food banks in Toronto alone by the time we celebrate Canada Day in this country. By the end of June, 6 months into the year, that number will be up to 250,000 visits a month. Yeah. So it's a real number. And we always focus on Daily Bread because it's such a large indicator. But this isn't specific to Toronto alone. I'm looking at the Mississauga News at Mississauga.com. And they're all excited and celebratory, as they should be. And I do not mean to diminish any of the work that these folks are doing on the front line. More than 640,000 pounds of food was collected by the food bank in Mississauga. Their holiday drive raised more than $1.9 million in Mississauga alone. The mayor of Mississauga, Bonnie Crombie, made the announcement. They published the story today. It was, you know, all the sponsors came out, and the food bank campaign ran from the 14th of November through to the first week of January. 450,000 pounds of food. That was their goal. And so they really blew it out of the park, right? All good. Thanks for your generosity, etc. The problem is Mississauga Food Bank has seen an 18% increase in the number of users every month on average compared to the same time in 2021. This is happening in your community. This is happening in your neighborhood. This is happening to people that you know. So it's time to start banging the drum, folks, dancing on desks. This is all great. But as my friends at the food bank will tell you, you know, we aren't here. They can't reduce poverty. In their words, it's time for bold. You hear Neil Hetherington, the CEO at Daily Bread, use that phrase all the time. Bold, systemic change that requires government at all levels to act. I mean, let's be bold. Let's have a minister of poverty in Ontario. Would that put a focus on it? Yeah. Well, just check it out if you want more details. dailybread.ca. Okay, can we get into this conversation a little bit about the whole standards, the national standards that were unveiled yesterday for long-term care, and how everybody's, you know, tripping over themselves to pat themselves on the back. These newly written standards offer a roadmap for long-term care. It's a true milestone. What a pile of bullshit that is. First of all, the standards aren't mandatory to begin with, the federal standards. They are presented by two different groups. One is in terms of the health care that's provided, and the other one is in the terms of the facility to make sure that they work. And here's the story, here's the quote out of the Toronto Star reporting. If mandatory and properly funded, the standards could help residents live with individual choice in activities, schedules, and lifestyle, including sexual identity. In the traditional homes that follow a medicalized model, those options do not exist. Here's the punchline. However, neither, quote, mandatory nor, quote, properly funded are guaranteed. No, they're not. And here's the real kicker for me. Quebec requires all of its homes to have accreditation. Ontario does not. And you might think, well, you know, how much better can it be? Remember during the pandemic, Quebec was ground zero for the crisis and the tragedy in long-term care. So these places were all accredited before we got to that point, right? And the idea being that if, you know, accreditation is the answer, it didn't help. It didn't help. So the accreditation numbers are there. Great. They aren't enforceable. They aren't mandatory. And when we begin to look at all the nonsense around, you know, the numbers that get thrown around and how they, you know, eternally patting themselves on the back at whatever level of government, I heard Paul Calandra on the radio this morning at News Talk 1010 with John Moore, and he is the minister responsible for long-term care here in this province. He's just saying, you know, well, we already got our standards and they exceed what they have in coming out of the feds yesterday. We've got the Fixing Long-Term Care Act that kicked in last April. And among other things, they made, you know, commitments to four-hour care, which is in these standards, rather, that the feds have trotted out. But they're not going to get there until 2028. So that's still 5 years from now. And the other thing is to add more beds. They're talking about 30,000 more beds by the end of this decade. Here's the problem. When we begin to look at the whole effect, you got to go back, maybe not that far, in fact. And when the government made a commitment, this government, this Ford government in Ontario, made the commitment to add 15,000 new beds. Well, guess what? They're 2 years behind on that already. As of January of this year, according to reporting by Catherine DeClercq at CTV, Seniors are waiting longer for beds in long-term care homes across the province. And it's adding to the projections that show the situation isn't likely to improve over the next decade. According to a progress report updated this month, there are nearly 40,000 people waiting for long-term care. And what does that mean? Well, overall, now 40,000 in Ontario waiting for long-term care. Overall, in Canada, there are just under 200,000 long-term care beds and about 6.8 million Canadians who are over the age of 65. Now, let's face it, most of those people, you know, aren't anywhere near the need for long-term care. But when you look at the way it's playing out right across the country, you know, Ontario still has the bulk of those beds just based on sheer volume and population. We aren't close to managing the commitment to add 15,000 beds, never mind the additional 30. So the wait list is just going to be unmanageable unless we do something fairly, you know, urgently. The other number that comes up here are the number of beds. So, you know, it's really hard to nail down what the number of beds are available in Ontario. And the government will tell you, well, it's because we're building more. Well, okay. Yeah, there are a number of places that are under construction, and they're all excited about that. But a lot of these places are only upgrading beds that already exist in existing long-term care facilities. These are institutionalized facilities that are very much on the model of the medicalized home, right? And what we need is less of that, and we need more of the smaller units so that within your community, there is a community of long-term care living residents, supported residents, you know, and these are, there are examples around the world where they have created communities within a community. And within the building, the facility itself, there may only be 10 people living there. But it's easier to manage in terms of access to the community and that. And that's where we need to go. There is no major push to be doing that kind of innovative build, innovative planning. I mean, I'm just looking at the list here that was published back in the fall based on the economic update. We've got, Temiskaming Lodge. 46 new long-term care beds, and then they're upgrading another 82. Okay, so it's in the same space, right? Sudbury, Extended Care Project, upgrade 256 long-term care beds. Runnymede Healthcare in Toronto, building a 200 new long-term care beds. But again, in that same facility. Again, 200 long-term care beds, great in one place. How do you get around that without it being institutionalized or medicalized? So that, those are the problems that we're going to face moving forward. And I think we really do need to get down to a situation where we, we don't have long-term care within the healthcare ministry. That is a mistake. We view it as something separate and apart. It's wrong. It needs to be part of our healthcare service, our healthcare support. It's great that we're talking about dental service. It's great that we're talking about childcare service. This needs to be part of that healthcare expectation, not just in Ontario, certainly right across the country. All right, here we go. A bit of a, I know I'm probably going to get grief for this, but yesterday we were in a meeting and we were talking about various details in terms of, doing a road trip to the United States. And quickly it came up. Oh, no, I know what it was. Aaron was talking about the language that you might use in a YouTube video, particularly if you are talking about audience development. And the suggestion was you have to be careful when you use the phrase targeted audience, particularly if, in fact, there has been a recent shooting. Because apparently, because you use the phrase targeted, YouTube just crushes the algorithm and your piece gets lost in all of this other stuff. So it's kind of scary to think, you know, you're just talking about how many more people you want to come to your YouTube channel. And you talk about a targeted audience. That is being picked up. And the reason it's being picked up, why, you wonder? Well, here we are. The final numbers for January 2023. 60. There have been 60 mass shootings in the U.S. That's just shy of two a day. 106 people killed. 232 wounded. All right, we mentioned off the top the Tyre Nichols funeral will be held today in Memphis, and so whether or not that's going to affect any change, we'll be watching that with interest. But I want to bring you the conversation that I had and rather enjoyed with our friend Courtney Betty from Betty's Law. To say that the video of the beating of Tyre Nichols was difficult to watch certainly understates it. But Courtney, as I watched that, I thought there's a whole bunch of conversations I know went on in newsrooms saying, do we broadcast this? Do we post it on our site? And I can see a day when we would have said no. We would not have done that. If for no other reason than we saw a young man being beaten to within an inch of his life and just by sheer coincidence or luck or whatever design, he didn't die there. He died elsewhere. I think it was the right call to publish that video. I'm not suggesting that we need to play it over and over and over again, but I don't think we otherwise would have fully appreciated the torture that he faced.
You know, for me, it was a very difficult decision. I've not watched the video. I made the decision not to watch the video. And I made that decision, interestingly enough, after I watched the mother at a press conference earlier on in the day. And I saw her agony and her pain. And I thought about what it was going to be like for her when she is now going to watch that video. Certainly, there is an element of public awareness that needs to happen. I'm not sure from a legal process, which actually is where my mind always goes, that this was absolutely necessary. And the kind of, I would use the word gently, media frenzy that occurred certainly generated a lot of discussion. But I think somewhere along the line, it causes either a desensitization to individuals that watch it, or even a further form of trauma. So it's something that I'm grappling with, but for me personally and my family, I told him, this is not something that you need to see, to understand. I understood his pain, I felt his pain, and my family, my daughter was in tears without seeing the video. I question the absolute necessity of showing the video.
And for those of you who are listening and you're not aware, Courtney is a black man and I'm a white guy. And where does that play into this? Because, the undercurrent of what you're telling me is that this is an experience you can identify with as being a black man in the 21st century. But as a white guy, quite frankly, I have not experienced that. And I say that with all due respect, and I'm trying the best to, not sound like an apologist for what happened. But at the same time, I'm not sure I would have fully appreciated exactly the kind of, physical danger that he was in just because he was a young black man.
And Dave, I never looked at it from that side. And I think from that standpoint, you're absolutely right that there is a benefit for others to understand what young black men have to go through and the lives that they live. I mean, this is an extreme situation, but it's not an abnormal situation of the kind of, various degrees the young black men, both in the United States and in Canada, have to face. So I do agree with you that there is that perspective of individuals that may say, oh, this doesn't really happen, this is not possible, to actually witness it. And if there's a mobilization effort that comes out of that, then fantastic. But I can see the perspective where, having been dealing with these kind of issues through my professional career and as a community person, I just didn't want my family to undergo another segment of pain. And I did the best that I could to protect them by saying, hey, this is what happened. You know, I saw the press conference. This is the full picture. You don't need to actually watch the video.
How much of this, and I've heard that almost to a point of distraction where we were beginning to split hairs over, well, the officers who have been charged are black. They beat a black kid to death. So race isn't an issue. And on the other hand, well, it is an issue because it's so ingrained and systemic in policing culture. I tend to kind of favor the latter commentary on this, and that if we want to use, you know, sort of the race of the police officers involved, it's almost a red herring here as an excuse not to deal with the real issue at hand, no?
And that was one of the tough parts, too, and I actually had a very lengthy discussion with my daughter, Justice, about that, you know, because I wanted the same kind of reaction from everyone that we would get, irrespective of the fact that the officers were black. I wanted people to understand that the fact that it was black officers doesn't change the situation. But it does give you an idea, and you know, I've worked with the RCMP, I developed a crime prevention program for the RCMP, I was a member of the Metro Toronto police basketball team for about 7 years. Like, policing is part of my life. I've been involved in that culture, whether as a prosecutor working with the police and others. And there is a challenge. There's a challenge within the culture. There's a challenge with police officers that if they feel that if they're not following along the path, they're going to be an outsider. So that concept of code blue means that, hey, this is the playbook. You follow that playbook, and if you don't, you're going to be sitting on the outside. So there's a lot of issues in terms of training and the mentality and the use of these kind of special units. And when you talk about special units, what you almost do is you give these officers carte blanche to break the law. We're saying, hey, we can't deal with it under the normal rules, so we're creating a special unit. You guys just go and do whatever you need to do, and get the problem solved. And again, that's another issue with policing.
Well, yes, and I think that is there's a certain expectation in the community that reflects first. The second part of that is, and it almost exacerbates it, is I was musing yesterday that when I was a kid, cops in town, and one of the, you know, one of my hockey coaches was a police officer. He would show up at the rink in uniform, and he would be wearing that baby blue shirt as part of their uniform, you know, and he would drive a yellow cruiser. The idea now that we have created this paramilitary view of what policing is, it doesn't just change the culture for police. It changes my own understanding, expectation, my own relationship with the police force, no matter what part of the community I live in. So I almost expect that show of force, that you know, on the edge of the law kind of view, if necessary.
Well, you know, it's interesting. You were playing hockey there with the police. I grew up in St. Clair and Oakwood area, and I was a basketball player, and we used to play basketball against the police, and it was great. I mean, we would have them come in on a Friday evening, the gym would be packed, and it was all just great at components of it and building those relationships. And, you know, when I developed the crime prevention program for the RCMP, hockey was a key part of it, because what I wanted the officers to do was to go out into the community, just like they did with basketball with myself and hockey with you, and connect with young people and others at that level as human beings. And, you know, that's really what we've lost. We've lost police community relations. And that's the key part of it now, because you can't solve crime just by enforcement. You know, we think that, okay, we can put a cruiser, you can get the best guns that's out there, all the forensics and all of that. It actually all starts in the community. And that's a message that, you know, I've been trying to bring to Toronto and to the mayor's office and to others. And, you know, because of this and other things, I've said, you know what, let me give it another shot again to see if we can get a real focus on community policing in the city.
When you look at that, in terms of that relationship with the community, and I know a lot of people will look at Toronto and certainly what's going on here in Canada and will immediately look at what happens in the United States. Well, yeah, we have a problem here, but it's not nearly as bad as it is in the United States. Is there a border there that actually draws that distinction?
You know, it's a fallacy that, and it gives us comfort in thinking that, right? But they're not talking to, you know, I was in criminal court last week, Tuesday. I haven't been in criminal court like for many, many years. I was helping out a former police officer whose son had a challenge. And it was one of the saddest days. I mean, every person that was coming out of that prisoner's box was someone that was diverse. So we have a challenge here. How do we get these individuals to become contributing members of our society? How do we change policing to make sure that they're not ending up in the prisoner's docks? What can we do before? And I think that's the element that we're missing. There is still a system that is built on getting into these communities and arresting individuals. Maybe it's not the best solution. Maybe there are alternatives that we should be looking at.
Given the, and you talked about the media frenzy, and I suspect that's almost a double-edged sword here in terms of having something come as a result of what we saw happen to Tyre Nichols. Is this incentive enough to really legislate a shift and a change or a foundational shift in the policing culture in the United States?
It won't be. You know, this is so ingrained right now because you can't change the culture that you've created. You can't. It's not possible. What you have to do is you've got to go back in the new trainees. It has to go back to the police college. Like, you have to reorientate and say, this is what policing means. You know, for example, if you go out and you see a kid that commits a crime, and somehow you're able to get that kid back on track and said, hey, you know, what you did was wrong, this and that, you know, whatever elements, you're not getting, that's not part of how you're being assessed for success. Right? So community policing does not come into the measurement that's going to take you to be the chief of police, right? So it's seen as a sidetrack in the same way. I mean, it's over 30 years that I developed that crime prevention program for the RCMP. Many officers were like, we don't want to participate because that's not real policing. And so you got to go back to the college because everything that they've been trained so far is that getting that gun, getting into a confrontation, that's what policing is about, and that's totally false.
Well, but there's also a political tinge to all of this that requires some level of courage, I suppose, because it's easy to win if people are outraged and afraid. And that gets at the heart of what you're talking about, right? If we're going to change the culture, then at some point we need some political leadership that says this is where it really has to start and have the willingness to put that on the line and make it happen. But too often, and I don't care what political stripe it is, you know, we're already calling for task forces to deal with the growing violence on transit systems across the country. And I understand why, but what that's appealing to is that real fear. So we're going to go in and bust a few heads or have a show of strength presence, and that's going to make us feel better.
Well, I'm hoping for Toronto, because I love Toronto, I'm hoping that will be part of John Tory's legacy. I'm really praying and I'm hoping, and I'm in contact with the mayor's office, that they will actually begin to lay the pathway. And I can tell you that there is a thinking there within the mayor's office. Now it's, how do we actually get it done? How do we create a budget for this? How do we ensure that the police itself, through the police board, the police commission, etc., that they recognize that this is critical in how their success is going to be measured? Because if you're not measuring their success by saying, okay, you've helped, you've done all of these things, then it really doesn't matter. Because the goal when you join the police, just like you're in broadcasting, I'm in law, you want to succeed. And you got to look at the matrix that are used to measure how you rise up the ranks. And right now, being a good guy, being a community guy, is not a matrix that's used to decide whether you're going to be getting promoted within our police force.
Okay, so the, how do we break that cycle? Because I've heard you say this for a number of years now, and it's it everybody kind of waves their hand and gets the, you know, the kumbaya lights going, and it all sounds great, but we have to break the cycle at some point. So where does that have to happen, Courtney?
The breaking the cycle begins absolutely with the mayor, because he's the one that actually appoints the police board. He's the one that sets the budget. So I think if the mayor says, listen, we want to look and we're going to have 1% of the police budget or 2% of the police budget is going to be going towards community policing. So then there's got to be an acceptance within the Metro Toronto Police Force. And that's where it has to start. And then you've got to appoint a chief of police who understands that crime prevention has to be one of the key pieces, not the only piece. We need officers to be out there. There's going to be arrests. There's going to be tough situations. There's guns on the street and all of those things. But there has to be some saying, well, is it 1%? Is it 2%? Is it 3% of whatever you do should be focusing on community policing?
But you, I know you've run into this already. You're going to get people saying, yeah, well, you know, the basketball courts and all that kind of thing. And that sort of uses the as the example of community policing. Where's the data that backs up the result that we want?
The data that backs it up, and what I've always looked at, because I'm a data guy myself, you look at the police athletic program in Detroit, you look at the police athletic program in New York, where they've got maybe 300 officers that are assigned, and this they can actually point to the changes that they've been able to bring in these communities in terms of reducing crime. So it's not something that's just, hey, let's all get together and hold hands. You can actually measure in these communities the changes are happening just by having these officers. They're full-time officers. That's their job. They get ranked, promoted, assessed based on the work they're doing in the community. And so you look at the changes that happen in the community, the lowering of crime in the communities, and what are the elements that the community is able to come together and build on.
Again, I just before we close, I just kind of want to go back to the close the loop on the Tyree Nichols story. I don't hear a lot of optimism from you in terms of, you know, what is the learning here? What is the possibility in terms of turning a page or, you know, maybe breaking some of that culture?
Well, I think part of it is interesting because the one thing that's different about this one that I do see is the role of the prosecutor to jump ahead of it. They didn't wait for the video. They were proactive. They said, this is what we're going to do. So that's a big change. And I think that there is a role for the prosecutor's office and the leaders within police to say, this is wrong, and we're going to treat it in the same way that we would treat any other crime. Because before, there was always a dancing, you know, was it a legitimate, was it this, that, and all those others. So for me, the one element that I do see that's positive is how they try to jump ahead of the story and actually make sure that as much as possible, it was, you know, it appeared to be an open book approach in dealing with this. And that's positive because before, you'd literally have to pull teeth bit by bit to kind of get the kind of information that we've gotten so far.
Well, and I think that's what I think you're right. I think that's what I found fascinating was, first of all, that the police chief acted quickly, that certainly the prosecutors acted quickly. We have seen other first responders getting, being disciplined for their inaction on the scene. So my suspicion is where we may not get a congressional reaction that people are calling for, you might actually at a grassroots level certainly be putting this up as an example of best practices moving forward in the worst situation.
That's exactly what needs to be done. And more importantly, they're going to see the benefits of this because so far we've not had, so far as I'm aware, you may know differently, any kind of explosion or violence or burning or looting and all of those, because they have actually given that community confidence that, hey, if something is wrong, we're going to deal with it, and we're going to deal with it head on. So for me, that's a huge benefit of what's come out of this.
Courtney, it's good of you to join us. Thanks for being here.
Oh, it's great to be here and great to see you, Dave. Have an amazing day.
All right, that'll do it for us here today on Now and Next. You can follow me on the social media at Dave Trafford. Finds me on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. Otherwise, you can drop us a line at Story Studio Network. Hello at storystudionetwork.com. And tomorrow on the program, we will have a conversation with our friend Mark Hennick. He's not only got a new podcast about mental health and well-being, but I just kind of want to get his take on some of the approaches around the violence that we're seeing on, certainly on the transit system in Toronto, but we're seeing it elsewhere, and how much of that is a result of our ignorance and our willingness to let the mental health file kind of just dangle off the side of our desk. He kind of predicted it during COVID. So we'll get his take on that. That's tomorrow, coming up right here on Now and Next. Talk to you then.
Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain.
Now and Next is produced by Becky Coles. Our production manager is Jamie Nickerson. Audio editors are Mike Trutler and Drew Garner. And our sonic logo designer is Greg McDonald. Our executive producers are Dave and Aaron Trafford.
This is SSN.
Story Studio Network.